The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 3 of Discover Extra Edition contains 5 stories from the July-August 2017 issue of Discover, covering greenhouse gases, the desert, criminal investigations, ancient DNA, and marijuana. What carbon really costs. Even if we curb emissions, wrangling greenhouse gases will mean a price tag of trillions. Atop Earth's largest active volcano, an alarm bell has tolled unheeded for 6 decades. In 1958, Scripps Institution climatologist Charles Keeling began making precise measurements of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations at Mauna Loa Observatory. Back then, Earth's atmosphere clocked roughly 310 parts per million of carbon dioxide. It took just a year for Keeling to spot a now familiar upward trend. You can think of it as taking planetary vital signs, says Ralph Keeling, who continues his father's work at Scripps today. The news isn't good. In April, carbon dioxide hit 410 parts per million, a 50% increase from pre-industrial revolution levels. And it's been increasing roughly 3 parts per million per year, a record rate. Last year, 175 countries agreed to reduce emissions via the Paris Agreement, which, optimistically, could hold global temperatures to an increase of 1.5 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial levels. We are almost there already, says glaciologist Eric Ringnaut of the University of California, Irvine. I think at some point, people will realize we've already passed it. Our current emissions trajectory locks Earth into a carbon dioxide level of at least 450 parts per million, Ralph Keeling says. And burning fossil fuels at the same increasing rates through 2050 would drive those levels to their highest point in 50 million years, according to an April study in Nature Communications. Add a few more centuries of similar emissions, and carbon dioxide levels rise to those not seen in 420 million years, causing unprecedented sea level rise. Keeling doesn't think it'll come to that. New efficiency standards and cleaner energy are already reducing emissions in the U.S. and other countries. If such efforts register at Mauna Loa, it could show humans still have some control. It's been an alarm bell so far, the curve, Keeling says, but if we start to take positive steps, it can become a sign of progress and hope. However, new research shows that reducing emissions isn't a complete fix. If you just stop emitting cold turkey, the temperature drops a little, but it doesn't drop too much, says MIT atmospheric scientist Susan Solomon. The temperature stays almost as hot for 700 years. That's because the carbon dioxide remains trapped in the atmosphere. Much of it lingers a millennium later, pumping more and more energy into the ocean. So temperatures stabilize, but the seas keep rising. This means humans actually have to remove greenhouse gases to reach levels scientists consider safe, roughly 350 parts per million. And even short-lived greenhouse gases, methane lasts about a decade, will still cause sea levels to rise for centuries. The reason is fairly simple. Greenhouse gases trap extra heat in our atmosphere, and oceans suck up most of it. As the warmer water expands, it causes sea levels to rise. And like a hot bath, the ocean must radiate its heat back out, through the atmosphere and into space, for it to cool. Former NASA scientist James Hansen, now at Columbia University, helped launch climate change into the public sphere with his 1988 testimony before Congress. A level of 450 parts per million would guarantee disaster, Hansen says now. If you leave it in place long enough, it would guarantee that you do lose the coastal cities. And in a recent study in Earth System Dynamics discussion, Hansen's team writes that to reach 350 parts per million, humans must spend the next century extracting billions of tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. They calculated a range of options to reach that threshold, putting the final price tag between $100 billion and over $1 trillion each year for roughly 80 years. They found that returning Earth to 350 parts per million by 2100 requires planting trees on an epic scale, as well as substantial investments to boost soil fertility so it holds more carbon. We'd also need large-scale tech to remove the gas, something not currently feasible. Others are exploring alternative approaches. A Harvard University program is spending $20 million to launch particles into the atmosphere to test a kind of solar shield. Some scientists fear that even talking about such geoengineering will embolden people to keep polluting. But that hasn't stopped the discussion. All the pollution we put in the air, we're going to have to take it back, Rignat says. The desert's living skin. Communities of tiny plants and organisms protect arid landscapes. Now their survival is threatened. On a cool September morning, a caravan of international scientists rumbles past the iconic formations of Canyonlands National Park in Utah. Over the eons, wind and water have carved this landscape into a maze of stunning red sandstone arches and spires. The researchers marvel at the formations, so different from their own backyards, places as distant as China, Niger, Australia, and Spain. But when they pull into the parking lot for a short hike to Pothole Point, their attention goes straight toward their feet. A thick, bumpy film covers large patches of the giant sandstone slabs. The patches resemble burnt soil, as if a fire left behind only these charred remains. Up close, the spots mimic the Canyonlands topography on a tiny scale. Centimeter-tall towers rise above a network of valleys. These dark, crusty soils span the arid Colorado Plateau in the Four Corners region. Here, the ground is alive. Biological soil crusts, or biocrusts, are crammed with communities of tiny photosynthetic organisms and other life forms. Biocrusts in some parts of the world are mostly cyanobacteria, one of the oldest microorganisms on Earth. Other biocrust communities, like these on the Colorado Plateau, include mosses, lichens, and fungi. The first scientists to study them called these living crusts cryptogamic, Greek for hidden marriage, because their inner workings were still mysterious. And while they might seem secretive, biocrusts are critical to healthy drylands around the world. But now, ecologists are worried that a changing climate will put them in jeopardy. Drylands cover nearly half of the world's land mass and sustain more than 2 billion people. Biocrusts are important components of these arid ecosystems. When it does rain, and in the desert southwest, summer rains come in monsoonal downpours, those peaks and valleys on the soil surface help retain the water. That both improves water absorption and reduces erosion. Biocrusts also add nitrogen and carbon to the nutrient-poor soil, a critical service for plants. And perhaps most importantly, the cyanobacteria's sticky slime and the root-like filaments of the mosses help bind soil to earth. The wind can whip through this ecosystem, almost knock you down, and this crust is going to stay 100% solid, says Sasha Reed, a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, Southwest Biological Science Center in Moab, Utah. Despite their resilience to wind, biocrusts crack under pressure. When hikers, bikers, and vehicles stray from established paths or livestock roam, they can leave a trail of bare earth where crusts used to live. Then, when the wind blows, those areas kick up sand. That dust is going to enter the atmosphere, says Reed. It's fertility leaving. It's going to be deposited elsewhere. And when dust from Utah settles on Colorado's snow-packed Rocky Mountains, those dark-colored sand particles speed up spring snowmelt by absorbing more solar energy. Because of the limited water of desert ecosystems and other factors, it can take a long time for these disturbed areas to recover. In the best-case scenario, cyanobacteria will recolonize the soil in 5 years or so. It takes another 20 years for a community rich with lichens and mosses to establish. In very dry places like California's Death Valley, scientists say full recovery takes up to 250 years. And alarmingly, recent studies show climate change can wipe out biocrusts just as surely as physical disturbance. Some 12 miles northeast of Moab, a thin electric fence partitions a mesa overlooking the Colorado River. Inside are 20 experimental plots where USGS researchers are simulating future climates to learn how biocrusts might respond. Infrared lamps overhang some sections, keeping them constantly 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the control plots. Other plots get regular doses of misted water. Some receive both. This allows scientists to look at the individual factors of warming and precipitation, and also study how those two factors might interact. We know the temperatures are going to increase, says Jane Belknap, a USGS ecologist and biocrust research pioneer. Precipitation, that's a lot more variable, and people don't really know what's going to happen. The future could bring light, regular rains. Or we might see more frequent, heavy rainfalls. Or perhaps less frequent, but even larger storms. Reed stands by a plot hit with both heat lamps and light, regular water treatments. The ground looks trampled. It's surprising that just a little water could cause this kind of damage. Reed and Belknap think the water gives the crusts just enough moisture to rev up metabolism, but not enough to replace the energy they've used, especially as heat speeds up evaporation. What's troubling is how quickly the warmed and watered crusts disappeared. They were barren in less than a year. You can tell right away which ones got watered, says Belknap. Everything used to look like that over there, she says, pointing to a distant control plot with visible thick crusts. It was stunning and disappointing. And somewhat gut-wrenching, says USGS researcher Scott Fehrenberg, the lead author on a paper analyzing data from these experiments. Other researchers, like Fernando Maestra, a professor at Rey Juan Carlos University in Spain, are doing similar experiments in other parts of the world. Nearly 75% of Spain is classified as drylands. Climate models predict really, really high warming for Spain, particularly during the summer. And summer in Spain is already really hot, he says. We need to know what is going to happen before we can think of ways of mitigating it. Maester's experiments are showing results similar to those from USGS. The future doesn't look good for biocrust communities, and thus for the stability of desert soils, as we continue to careen toward a warmer climate. But researchers still hold out hope. We're trying to turn to a more optimistic phase to see if there's some way we could help these communities to return, says Fehrenberg. Several universities are trying to culture biocrust organisms in greenhouses and reintroduce them to damaged landscapes. Results are mixed so far. In China, government scientists sprayed a cyanobacteria-loaded slurry over growing sand dunes and stopped their advance. But recent experiments in New Mexico and Utah have been hit or miss. And it's not clear why. The jury's out in terms of restoration and how much success we might have in the face of climate change, says Fehrenberg. Scientists are also exploring assisted migration, a controversial topic in ecology where species are moved from a place they currently thrive in to places they might survive as the globe warms. The Moab USGS team just began a new common garden experiment to see which crust communities might fare the best in a warmer Utah. They gathered crust samples from different ecosystems across the Southwest and grew them in a greenhouse at Northern Arizona University. Early this year, the team spread those samples in adjacent Utah plots. Similar to climate manipulation plots near the Colorado River, half of these plots are warmed with infrared lamps to simulate the future. Right now, the plots look like sand with confetti colors. So we're waiting to see how those communities take shape over time, says Reed. If the native crusts can't withstand the expected warming, maybe the crusts already adapted to hotter deserts could. In the end, perhaps preserving the biocrust's ecosystem function is more important than preserving species native to the Colorado Plateau. Everything worth knowing about catching a criminal, getting an edge with high-tech and lowly microbes. In 13th century China, a field worker was killed with a sickle, and all villagers' sickles were alike. So the investigator had every worker lay down his tool in a field and observed that just one sickle attracted blowflies, which were known to seek out blood. Its owner, the culprit, immediately confessed. The Chinese sickle slaying is one of the first reported cases of forensic investigation. The role of science in evidence collection and presentation has only become more important over time, and it continues to evolve at an ever-accelerating pace. New discoveries are bolstering even the oldest techniques, such as fingerprinting, first systematized by Englishman Sir Francis Galton in 1892. For instance, in 2015, National Institute of Standards and Technology chemist Shin Muramoto found that ridges on a fingerprint release a substance known as palmitic acid at a predictable rate, allowing investigators to determine when prints were laid down and whether they're temporally relevant to a crime. And at the University of Albany, chemist Jan Halamek recently published a method to determine the sex of the person who left a print based on proportion of amino acids found in skin oils. One of the most significant developments in forensics, the advent of DNA profiling in the 1980s, also continues to advance. More than just a means of tying a suspect to a crime scene, genetic information can reveal clues about a culprit's appearance through a process called DNA phenotyping. Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, geneticist Susan Walsh has successfully predicted eye and hair color based on genetic markers known as single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs. And Pennsylvania State University anthropologist Mark Shriver has used SNPs to make predictive digital mugshots. DNA phenotyping has met some skepticism, which is important given an individual's freedom may be on the line. Overconfidence and pseudoscience both have a long and tragic history in forensics. Exhibit A? Galton, the father of fingerprinting, falsely claimed that criminal tendencies could be detected in the faces of people who physically resembled known lawbreakers. Last year, a study released by the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology raised a fresh round of concerns, finding inadequate scientific support for standard techniques, ranging from ballistics testing to blood spatter analysis. However, forensic science is also a powerful technique to scrutinize itself, as researchers discover and correct past inadequacies. Studying the reasons why blood spatter can be misleading, Loyola University, Maryland biologist David Rivers recently observed that the blood was sometimes spread by flies. So, in a move that would surely have impressed medieval China's CSI, Rivers developed a spray that could distinguish bug-borne splatter by detecting fly gut enzymes in bloodstains. Check out some other cutting-edge ways researchers are advancing established investigation methods. First, examining the victim. When investigators find a body, they want to know how long ago the victim died. There are numerous established techniques, but each has significant limitations. Rigor mortis isn't very precise over extended periods, and the presence of telltale insects varies by region. In contrast, Microbes are always present at a death scene, says Colorado State biologist Jessica Metcalf. And the rise and fall of microbial populations follows a reliable course as a corpse decomposes, even though the actual pace of activity varies widely due to temperature and other environmental factors. Over the past several years, Metcalf and colleagues have developed a microbial clock to measure postmortem passage of time by genetically sequencing the population of microbes on the skin and in the surrounding soil. Their experiments at body farms, outdoor facilities where scientists study the decomposition of donated cadavers, have established a timekeeping accuracy of 2 to 4 days over a 25-day period. The microbes can also show whether a corpse has been moved and reveal the original location. Tools from metagenomics, sampling trace genetic material in the environment, and methods of studying the human microbiome are providing insights into disease while bolstering the crime-fighting potential of bacteria and fungi. We're also working on using skin microbes as trace evidence to link people to objects they recently touched or spaces they have recently occupied, says Metcalf. Invisible and ubiquitous, microbes are the ideal witnesses. 2. Investigating the scene of the crime. From protein markers for hair to microbial clocks for cadavers, to sprays for detecting fly gut enzymes in blood splatter, the tools and techniques of forensic investigation now extend beyond the expertise of any single investigator. As a result, the enzymes, microbes, and proteins that could prove crucial to catching a criminal might easily be overlooked at the scene of a crime. Bringing in large groups of experts would be impractical, wasting precious time and potentially contaminating evidence. Working in collaboration with the Dutch National Police, researchers at the Delft University of Technology have come up with a solution that looks somewhat like Pokemon Go. Arm CSIs with augmented reality, AR. Investigators wearing shoulder-mounted cameras allow off-site specialists to observe the investigation in real time. They can even annotate the crime scene video feed with text and arrows that the CSI on the ground can see on a wrist-mounted screen, or through glasses like Microsoft's HoloLens. The mobile policeman will be able to get in contact with remote experts and solve cases more easily together, explains Dragos Dekku, a former Delft University of Technology researcher who now heads research for a Dutch AR company called Twinkies. Twinkies plans to commercialize the system for law enforcement by the end of the year. If it catches on, the Sherlock Holmes of the future may find himself with a desk job. And third, identifying the culprit. DNA profiling is universally accepted as the highest standard for identification in forensics, and it has been used successfully for decades to convict or exonerate suspects. In fact, a 2009 National Research Council report on forensic science eviscerated all other identification techniques, from fingerprinting to bite mark analysis, holding DNA as uniquely capable of reliably distinguishing between any two people on Earth. But DNA also has limitations. It can degrade and be difficult to extract from trace evidence such as skin and hair. So Glendon Parker, a biochemist at the University of California, Davis, has been studying unique markers in the proteins made by DNA. The major advantage is that protein, particularly hair protein, is more stable than DNA, he explains. Protein-based identification relies on the mechanism that makes DNA valuable for forensic identification. Single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, used as genetic markers in DNA profiling, can produce single amino acid polymorphisms, SAPs, in the amino acids that make up protein. The challenge for criminal investigation is to find a set of SAPs that can be easily isolated and are collectively unique for each human being. Parker and his colleagues have already identified more than 100 protein markers, which together can pinpoint one person out of 15 million. They've also shown that these proteins are stable enough in hair to identify 250-year-old human remains. However, there is a gap between feasibility and implementation, Parker notes. We still need to optimize sample processing so a single hair can be analyzed. And they need to find the SNPs that can identify one person out of 7.4 billion. He gives it a few years, and in the interim, expects to extend his technique to skin flakes. Criminals with dandruff, beware! Everything worth knowing about ancient DNA, the lure and limitations of a coded past. In 1984, geneticists recovered 229 base pairs of genetic code from a quagga, a subspecies of zebra extinct since the late 1800s. The achievement proved DNA could survive in dead things and spurred a new field of science, paleogenetics. Today, technological advances allow scientists to read billions of letters from the genomes of ancient humans and other organisms, transforming our view of history and evolution. The genetic record is like a lost library, and we're just starting to learn the language of all those books that we have uncovered, says Johannes Kraus, director of archaeogenetics at the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Jena, Germany. For anthropologists, ancient DNA, ADNA, provides insights that could not be gleaned from fossils or artifacts. It's already settled some major debates, including whether modern humans interacted with Neanderthals. Ancient genomes show definitively that our ancestors not only met, but mated with Neanderthals, multiple times, between 40,000 and 100,000 years ago. In 2015, ADNA confirmed that Kennewick Man, an 8,000-year-old skeleton found in Washington State in 1996, was genetically closest to Native Americans. The revelation ended a 20-year legal battle and allowed tribes to rebury the bones. Ancient DNA has also brought surprises. In 2010, the genome of a pinky bone from Siberia revealed the existence of Denisovans, a previously unknown type of human that lived around the same time of Neanderthals. Denisovan ADNA also shows they interbred with the ancestors of some living humans, contributing genes beneficial in cold environments and at high altitudes. A decade ago, those discoveries were not possible. Geneticists could only read short stretches of ancient genomes. Consequently, studies focused either on particular genes or on narrow portions of DNA, the male Y chromosome or maternally inherited code called mitochondrial DNA. These short sequences do not reflect an individual's complete ancestry. For that, researchers need DNA from across the full genome. Obtaining it from living humans is not difficult, but it's a formidable challenge to extract and sequence genome-wide ADNA, which can degrade into fragments, undergo chemical reactions that change its code, and be contaminated by modern DNA. With the recent development of specialized methods for genome-wide analysis of ADNA, the power of archaeogenetics has really been unleashed, says Kraus. Now encompassing a 500,000 years and hundreds of individuals, ancient DNA studies are revising our understanding of major events, such as the origins and spread of agriculture. Because ADNA can be used to track the evolution of diseases and human resistance to them over time, it's also valuable to medical research. And researchers are already working on identifying the genes unique to modern humans, at the most basic level, what unites and defines our species. Decoding ADNA 101. Step 1. Extraction. In a sterile lab, bones and other surviving tissues are cleaned, crushed into powder, and dissolved with chemicals that isolate short DNA strands. Step 2. DNA soup. Despite cleaning, the extract is a soup of DNA from the sample and contaminated material, mostly microbes from soil where the remains were buried. Researchers add molecular tags that will later work like barcodes, selectively binding to DNA to inventory and find particular sequences. Step 3. Copies. To read the DNA quickly and accurately, computers must analyze millions of copies simultaneously. Geneticists make these copies by heating double-stranded DNA, causing it to separate. Enzymes then build new double strands from each half. Repeating the procedure makes two strands into four, then four into eight, and so forth, until millions of strands have identical DNA codes and tags. Because human genomes are over 99% identical, researchers often selectively copy only the parts that differ. 4. Sequencing. In the final round of copying, geneticists chemically color the different nucleotide bases, better known by their letters A, T, C, and G. Computers then read the code based on the order in which the colors appear, analyzing all the identical strands with matching tags at the same time to weed out any errors. Step 5. Authentication. Researchers use a number of clues to discard contaminants in the ancient code. For example, ADNA strands are usually shorter than 100 letters, with predictable degradation patterns. 6. Alignment. The short strands that have been read need to be aligned into their proper positions across the full genome. Software lines them up based on overlapping stretches of code and comparisons with previously sequenced reference genomes. Take it to the limit. Don't get your hopes up for dino DNA. Studies conducted in the 1990s, reporting genetic code from fossils over 50 million years old, have since been rejected as cases of contamination. Most ADNA has come from samples younger than 50,000 years, and from cold climates. Although paleogenetics is advancing technologically, it will always be limited by preservation. Researchers can't extract DNA from specimens that no longer have any. When organisms die, their DNA decomposes. How long this takes depends on factors like temperature, burial conditions, and the number of microbes making a meal of it. Calculations predict that in the optimal conditions, very cold ones, DNA could survive around 1 million years. To date, the title for oldest complete genome belongs to a horse unearthed from frozen ground in Yukon, Canada, and dated to be 560 to 780,000 years old. The oldest DNA from a member of our Homo genus is a fragment of genetic code from 430,000-year-old Neanderthal ancestors found in Spain's Cima de los Huesos cave, which stays at a cool 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Geneticists are starting to have success in warmer places, which is a priority, because most of human evolution occurred in Africa. Recently, they discovered that DNA preserves best with up to 100 times higher recovery rates in the petrous bone. Samples of this tiny, dense part of the skull from places such as the Middle East have yielded ADNA that's up to 12,000 years old. Everything worth knowing about marijuana. The blunt truth. Humans have used marijuana, or cannabis sativa, for thousands of years, for religious purposes, medical remedies, or simply getting high. These days, 1 in 8 Americans ingest or smoke marijuana, and the drug faces renewed scrutiny as more states wrestle with legalization. While the legislative battles rage on, scientists continue to study the effects this plant can have on us, therapeutic and otherwise. But the work isn't easy. The U.S. government hasn't legalized marijuana and still classifies it as a Schedule I drug with high potential for abuse, no accepted medical use, and no safe use under medical supervision. To study it, experts must secure samples with a Drug Enforcement Administration stamp of approval. That makes for some serious restrictions for researchers, though they've made some headway. Know your lingo. Cannabinoids. Any chemical that interacts with the cannabinoid systems in the body. These can include cannabinoids that come from the plant, from the body, or from synthetic variations. Phytocannabinoids. Cannabinoids that come naturally from the cannabis plant. Endocannabinoids. Cannabinoids the body makes on its own. The body's cannabinoids. In the 1990s, researchers realized humans can produce their own cannabinoids through the body's endocannabinoid system, ECS. The ECS is a complex chemical signaling system that has two main receptors located in many areas of the body. The big players. Cannabis sativa has hundreds of chemical compounds, from fatty acids to the terpenes that give it its distinct smell. But the most studied are cannabinoids. Here are the most common cannabinoid subclasses and their general impact on the body. First, cannabidiols, CBD, painkiller, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, anxiety reducer, antipsychotic, suppresses muscle spasms. 2. Tetrahydrocannabinols, THC, painkiller, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, euphoriant, suppresses nausea and vomiting. 3. Cannabigerols, CBG, painkiller, anti-inflammatory, antibiotic, antifungal. 4. Cannabichromines, CBC, painkiller, anti-inflammatory, antibiotic, antifungal. 5. Cannabinols and cannabinoidols, CBN, CBND, anti-inflammatory, antibiotic, sedative, anticonvulsant. And finally, others, includes cannabis cyclols, CBL, cannabielsoins, CBE, cannabitriols, CBT, and other miscellaneous types. Good for what ails you. Scores of studies have found that cannabinoids can help with specific disorders and diseases, but not all studies are created equal. Many of them use different doses, administer those doses differently, and can use combinations of cannabinoids with different ratios. So a lot of the results are hard to compare and don't always agree. Here are some disorders and diseases where cannabinoids seem medically helpful. Psychiatric neurological disorders. Anxiety and pain disorders. CBD reduces symptoms. Schizophrenia. CBD reduces psychotic symptoms. Parkinson's. CBD alleviates psychotic symptoms and some issues with motor control. Heart function. A THC and CBD combination relaxes some arteries. Digestion complications. THC eases chemo-related nausea and vomiting, helps improve symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. Immune system complications. THC and CBD combination alters growth and function of certain immune cells. Sleep disorders. THC improves sleep quality and quantity for some people. CBD increases alertness. Anti-inflammatory. All of the most common cannabinoids relieve swelling. Pain. Most of the common cannabinoids relieve pain. Other disorders. Multiple sclerosis. THC alleviates MS-related pain. THC and CBD combination reduces muscle spasms. AIDS. THC increases appetite and helps with weight gain. Epilepsy. CBD reduces convulsions. Cancer. THC and CBD combination reduces chemo-related nausea and vomiting, manages pain, and stimulates appetite. There's always a downside. Plenty of promising research shows the pros of marijuana use, but also some serious cons. Brain function and mental health. Long-term use could lead to panic disorders and psychosis. If you're a long-time user who started lighting up in your teens, your hazy days could predispose you to depression. To top it off, Repeated exposure to THC can have a negative effect on areas of your brain that deal with forming memories, like the hippocampus and prefrontal cortex. Heart health. Even minor use of cannabis can cause your heartbeat to ramp up and mess with your blood pressure levels and blood flow. Research has shown both increases and decreases in blood pressure. Sexual and reproductive health. Men, if you're looking for some action, best mind your marijuana habits. Chronic use can lead to erectile dysfunction and a decrease in overall sexual functioning, pleasure, orgasm, desire, and arousal. And if you want to start a family, there's more bad news. THC has been shown to restrict sperm mobility and its ability to fuse with eggs. Very heavy male users who smoke 8 or more joints daily even risk reducing their sperm count. As for women, researchers have yet to really investigate how cannabis impacts them between the sheets, and studies looking at human female fertility have been inconclusive. Dependence. You can't overdose on cannabis, but you can develop a dependence. Up to 17 million people globally meet the official classification when it comes to cannabis. Hallmarks include inability to lessen intake, using even if you've had physical or psychological issues related to cannabis, and spending more time than you'd like seeking to buy the drug and recovering from its effects. If you're trying to kick the habit, expect symptoms such as mood swings, a lack of appetite, and trouble sleeping. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.